My first guests this morning are Barbara Hatch and Karen Lee. Barbara is the director of The Mad Woman of Chaillot, opening Friday, this Friday, January 9th at the Santa Fe Playhouse, and running, I think, for 4 weekends.
4 weekends, exactly. Good morning.
Good morning. And Karen Lee plays the Countess Aurelia, the Mad Woman of Chaillot.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. Hang in here with us, guys. For the second half, you'll hear a wonderful pre-recorded segment with Rick and Judy Cormier. Rick is the head of a freestyle drumming circle here in Santa Fe, and we pre-recorded that segment in the studio, so the drumming is fabulous. Welcome again, Barbara and Karen. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Hollis. Thank you. Nice to see you.
So before we talk about this play, I'd like to hear a little bit about each of your backgrounds in theater.
A long and illustrious career. No, I've been working in theater since I was a teenager, really. I've just got bitten by the bug when I was in high school, and I studied it in college at NYU, and there was a short hiatus, about 9 years, when I lived in France. I lived there for about 9 years, and I didn't do much theater there. And then I came back to the States and taught theater and worked with a rep company in New Jersey. And then I moved here, and here I am. And Playhouse, Theater Grotesco, and a lot of other things.
Yeah. You're the managing director.
Managing director of Theater Grotesco. Uh-huh. Yes.
In your real job.
In my day job, which is absolutely fabulous, because I get to do what I love and what I'm passionate about, working in the theater, with the theater, around the theater, pretty much 24 hours
and
a day.
And they pay you money.
And I get paid.
Wow. And then at night you go get to do all this other stuff.
I get to do all this other stuff. So yeah. I act and I direct and I teach and yeah. So
great.
There
thanks.
You go.
Karen, your life story in 15 seconds or less.
I'll spare you. I'll do just the highlights here. But I too go back a long time. I think it was 1975. I was quite young when I started studying in like ninth grade, and I continued studying in college, and then ultimately went to New York to the American Academy there, and I just love. I'm kind of old school. I also love behind the scenes and doing work and costume and things like that. And I don't know, the bug does hit us pretty early. So.
Now, it's to my knowledge, you're like sort of the leading lady of Santa Fe. You're always on stage in some leading role. It's Karen Lee.
It's
no
been
kidding.
A while, though. It's been about a year since
a whole
I've been
year.
On stage. But I took like 8 years off. Mm-hmm. And when I first moved back here in 99, I didn't do so much. It's fits and starts. And more of a character actor, I must say. Always.
Right. Yeah, you tend to play the heavy roles. So, Barbara, tell us the story of The Mad Woman of Chaillot.
The Mad Woman of Chaillot takes place in Paris in the 1940s. Well, we don't have a specific date, so it was written in 1943 by Jean Giraudoux. So it takes place in Paris in the 1940s. And the first act takes place in a cafe, a sidewalk street cafe called Café Chez Francis. And the second act in the basement of the Countess Aurelia, who is sitting right next to me. Basically what happens is that there's a group of businessmen who are discussing, there's a president and a baron, and the president is trying to get the baron to be on the board of directors and lend him his name to create a company. He doesn't know what the company is going to be, he just knows that he's going to have a company to make himself some more money. And he's looking for a deal, he's looking for some kind of a thing. And he sees a man across the cafe, and this turns out to be a prospector who has been prospecting for oil all over the world, all over the planet, who believes that he has found oil under the streets of Paris. And not only under the streets of Paris, but right here under this very cafe. And he wants to dig for oil. But the city architect will not give him a permit to dig for the oil. And so he has decided that he has hired a young man who can refuse him nothing to blow up the city architect's building. So we have a little bit of terrorism in there. And he says basically that the next city architect will be more willing to be to help him out and get a permit. The Countess and her friends basically overhear this plot to destroy the city. And the Countess, being a brave, modern woman, takes matters into her own hands, puts these evil men, evil, I put that between quotes because it's very arbitrary, but they're the evil ones, puts them on trial and renders judgment. I won't tell you what the judgment is until people come to see it.
Okay, so Karen, is the mad woman really mad?
I would say that she's eccentric, yes, but not mad. And what does mad really mean? You know, she's her own person. She lives on her own terms. She chooses to live really in another time, mm-hmm. Rather than the time period that the play is set, which is in the 40s. And is she mad? I don't know that that's such a terrible thing.
Mad has so many definitions.
Yes, yeah.
Mad has very specific definitions.
Or is it even an important question? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's
yeah. So before we go any further, if people want to get tickets, do they go to the Playhouse website?
They can go to the Playhouse website, www.santafeplayhouse.org. Or they can call the box office, 505-988-4262. So we have a new online ticketing system, which is wonderful.
Great.
We're trying to transition just to this online ticketing. So people can go directly to the website. They can still make their reservations by phone. Online ticketing, of course, you pay in advance, whereas by phone you can just go up to the box office and do will call. So we still have both options, but www.santafeplayhouse.org.
She's done this before.
No, never.
So I pressed upon Karen when she came in this morning and said, gee, won't you read a little for us from the play? And that wasn't quite fair, but she's very game, and I really appreciate that.
Yay.
Will you read that wonderful selection?
Certainly.
So may I set it up just a little bit?
Set it up, Barbara.
So this young man who was sent by the prospector to blow up the building has had had qualms about it and couldn't go through with it. And so he was about to throw himself off a bridge and is rescued. And now the Countess is trying to convince him that life is worth living, that life is beautiful. And so there.
Okay, take it away, Karen. Or take it away, Mad Woman of Chaillot.
Thank you, Hollis. To be alive is to be fortunate, Roderick. Of course, in the morning when you first awake, it doesn't always seem so very gay. When you take your hair out of the drawer and your teeth out of the glass, you're quite likely to feel a little out of place in this naughty world. Particularly if you've just been dreaming that you're a little girl on a pony looking for strawberries in the woods. But all you need in order to feel the call of life again is a letter in the mail giving you your schedule for the day. You write it to yourself the day before. That's the safest. Here are my assignments for this morning. To mend my petticoats with red thread, to curl my ostrich feathers, to write my grandmother, etc., etc. And when I've washed my face with rose water and powdered it, not with this awful rice powder they sell nowadays, which does nothing for the skin, but with a cake of pure white starch, and put on my pins, rings, brooches, pearls, bracelets, and earrings. In short, when I'm dressed for my coffee and have had a good look at myself, not in the glass, naturally, it lies, but in the side of the brass gong that once belonged to Admiral Courbet. Then, Roderick, then I'm armed, I'm strong, and I'm ready to begin again.
Thank you, Karen, very much.
Sure.
As you noted, Barbara, before when we were talking about this selection, taken out of context, you have a whole different feeling about it. It sounds like this petty woman talking about her petty day and a rich, privileged woman at that. But instead, she's actually genuinely trying to talk this young man into understanding that life goes on.
Yes. That life goes on. That life is worth living. That even as bad as things seem in the world or might be, that he still has a reason to get up every morning and do these banal things as she does. Mm-hmm. You know, and as we said before, she and her friends, three other wonderful mad women who come in the second act, just absolutely delightful. I can't stand it. All these four women are not living in the 1940s. In there, they have chosen a time period that for them, they were younger, they were fresher, there were less pressures on them, there wasn't this war that they were going through. Even though the war is set in the 1940s, we never talk about World War II or anything that's going on. They have chosen a time period that was simpler for them. And they live in Victorian era, and men were different, and women were different, and life was different. So,
well, maybe not so different.
And maybe not.
There's that one little part about what men are truly like.
Mm-hmm.
That's lovely. You've directed this play three times before.
This is the third time I'm working on this. The first was in the late '90s. I assistant directed and was in it,
mm-hmm.
and then I did a high school production of it. I was teaching high school on the East Coast, and I had a cast of over 30 high school students.
Wow.
So, and then, of course, now this one. And it's wonderful because you think about Aurelia, she's timeless. She can be played by a woman Karen's age. The first production that I did, the woman who played her was in her 80s. Greer Garson, I think,
wow.
did it. She was in her mid-70s when she did it here in Santa Fe in 1975.
Oh.
So this is a woman who embodies strong women. Even though she may seem to be mad and eccentric, she is the most sensible woman, basically, on the planet. She takes a very practical tack to changing the world.
Mm-hmm. So you've got something like 25 actors?
24 actors, yes. 24 actors on the stage of the Santa Fe Playhouse, and they are...
It's crowded.
You know, but it doesn't ever feel like it.
Yeah.
It's the most amazing thing. One would think that it would be absolutely insane, and yet the way we've been working, they have learned to navigate around each other. They have turned into this incredible ensemble, and every single piece fits beautifully. And I cannot be more proud of this cast. They're amazing.
So, and some people play more than one role.
Some actors do play. I have one actor who's playing four roles, a couple of them are two or three. Because there are 38 characters in this play, nobody's ever done it with that many actors. So there is always doubling up.
And there are some other well-known Santa Fe regulars in this
yes.
place. Name a few of them. I know you can't name all 24 out of your head.
I wish I could. But for instance, Rod Harrison plays the rag picker, who is sort of the counterpart and right hand of the Countess. He's the head of the vagabonds. There's a group of vagabonds who live in this area. Then we also have Virginia Hall Smith, who plays the Countess the Mademoiselle Gabrielle. And we have Jennifer Graves, who is Madame Constance. Rose Provan, who is Madame Josephine. Those are the four mad women. Michael Graves, Tone Forrest, plays... the prospector, dun dun dun, and so on. We just have so many wonderful actors. Some who have our cast range is 13 years old to I won't name the top number because I'm not even sure what it is. But we have this incredible age range. Wonderful men, wonderful women. It's just beautiful.
That's
very
great.
Exciting.
So we talked a little bit before about how timely this play seems. When I read this play, and I had not read it before, I was sort of blown away.
It is.
I mean, from the very first words where it the very setup that this guy wants to drill for oil under the cafe in Paris.
Yes.
And doesn't care at all what he destroys. And that you can almost look at these characters as archetypes. They almost are. They are called the president, the baron, the prospector, the broker. But they're very specific human beings who we all know. They're called the evil ones because they seem to care only about themselves, their own personal gain, their own personal profit. And they're juxtaposed to the vagabonds, who are the little people, the ones who are the downtrodden in some way, the ones, the homeless, the who would seem to be, one would think they would be the sad ones, and yet they have this incredible joie de vivre, this incredible desire to keep the world a beautiful place,
mm-hmm.
to not destroy the flowers and the parks and the museums and the art and history.
Yeah, as I was reading through this, I mentioned before, I work with the homeless. Mm-hmm. And in reading the vagabonds and about them, yes. I felt very much akin to the people that I work with.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
you know,
yes.
And their lives.
And it's really interesting, when we were working on this, each vagabond has sort of a backstory.
You know what? You're having trouble with your headphones.
I am. Can
I know.
You hear me?
Let me see. Hang on just a second. Karen, why don't you tell us what's the most challenging thing about your role?
Well, it's been quite a journey. This has been a bit of a bear for me personally. It's very different. Part of that is a technical aspect when you enter on stage and then you stay there through the whole
for
play.
A long time.
Oh, you
I never
leave the stage?
Once I'm on,
wow.
I never leave.
No potty breaks.
No.
That's it. Except intermission. Just a couple of minutes at intermission.
It's a lovely ride, and then I get to interact with everyone.
Yeah.
And I think finding Karen in Aurelia, and I finally did that, and they merged, because you have the technical aspect and the how you carry yourself, this and that, but there has to be heart in there. Mm-hmm. And it was a long time coming, but I think the last 3 days or so,
it's clicking into place beautifully.
I'm loosening up and letting go a little bit of, you know, just being on stage and
So are you talking about the part of yourself that can identify with her?
Yes.
And can you articulate what that is that you found?
You know, it's always difficult to for me, it's difficult to articulate it because my articulation comes in performance. But it's always different with me. This particular play, because of the language, and you want to get it as right on as possible. You want to do that with all playwrights.
Yeah.
But this has such a beautiful musicality to it. Mm. But she's still talking. She's mm-hmm. still communicating. And she's still real, even mm-hmm. though she's eccentric. And melding those two to where it's not all surface. And I think letting go for me mm-hmm. and not worrying about that, because I've done my work.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And now breathing and having fun and not worrying so much, and that sounds so superficial the way I'm explaining it. Mm-hmm. It's one of those mysteries.
It's a mystery.
You know, whenever we talk about something that's really deeply meaningful, it
yes.
has a tendency to sound trite because
yes.
we've heard it before.
Right.
So the idea of letting go or surrendering to the character,
right.
you know, and surrendering to yourself and
yes.
your unconscious ability to, you know, put that person out there.
Right.
But it's true. Trite but true, you know.
And the vagabonds, as Karen, personally, they're the ones I relate to the most.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I guess most people do, but that's more me in life than being the countess or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But she is so connected to them just because she has this title and was born into this position.
Yep.
She's a very perceptive woman and
mm-hmm.
very in tune and empathetic person.
Yeah.
But she can call a spade and recognize, she can recognize someone that's insincere and superficial,
mm-hmm.
which,
yeah.
you know, so interesting.
I'm talking with Barbara Hatch, the director, and Karen Lee, the leading lady in The Mad Woman of Shiloh, which is opening Friday at the Santa Fe Playhouse.
We do have a sneak preview on Thursday night.
Oh, okay. you can get tickets by going to the website, www.santafeplayhouse.org. They have a new online ticketing service that should work really well for you.
It does.
Yeah,
it works great.
Yeah, so let's talk some more about how this playwright did this. You were telling me earlier that he wrote this. He had written many, many plays. He was a government worker.
Mm-hmm. I think he was a communication specialist.
Oh, so let's tell all those people who work for the state, there is hope.
There's hope. There's definitely hope. Absolutely. And so he wrote this play actually in 1943. He passed away in 1944, and I was telling you that the first time it was ever performed was posthumously. It was January of 1945.
But just a year after his death.
Less than a year
performed.
After his death, yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I think that he was, you know, he was one of those people. He could not speak out in his life in the government where he was. He had his opinions and he had his, the way he saw the world. But
Paris was still occupied.
Paris was still occupied.
By the Nazis, yes.
Exactly. And it's most interesting because there's not a single reference to the Nazis or to the occupation or to this war. It talks about war in general. The reason these men are digging for oil is because they want to make war, because one makes a profit by war. And that's what they're all about. But there's no mention of any of that specifically. And even the authority figures who are shown in the play, there's a police sergeant and a brand new police officer, first day on the beat, who actually rescues this young man. They are very benevolent. They're kind of a part of the vagabonds. They're friendly to the vagabonds. So there's sort of these different levels, societal levels. You have the baron, the president, the broker, the prospector, who are the ones who are out only for themselves. Then you have the waitress, Irma, and Pierre, the young man, and a few other characters, the policeman, the sergeant, who are sort of this middle ground. And then the vagabonds, who are they're the marginal, the societal marginals, mm-hmm. who occupy this cafe. They swarm around the Countess Aurelia. They protect her. They are her. They are her friends. They are her protectors. So we have these three levels, and they all sort of coexist together in some bizarre way.
Mm-hmm. Not unlike our real society.
And just exactly as society today. And we have these different hierarchical levels of people that are out there. So, yeah.
So, and it's very much, there's a lot of tension between the rich and the poor, the idea of rich and poor mm-hmm. in this play. But is it funny?
Yes, it actually really is. And I can't wait. It's hard for the, you know, I'm laughing because I know it and I love it and I hear it every day. But it's going to be really wonderful for the actors to hear the audience laugh. We had a couple of people come to a dress rehearsal Sunday afternoon, and it just came to life for them the first time that they had strangers other than me.
It makes a
huge difference. And there are a lot of really wonderfully funny, and then they're very touching moments and very, very, very pointed, poignant moments, and there are lines that people, I hope, walk away with and say, oh my gosh, that really struck home with me.
Can you think of one?
Oh my gosh. Can I think of one right now? Here, let's refer to the book. Well, the rag picker has a bunch of different wonderful things that he says when he's talking about how, you know, I can't really say too much about it, but he...
talking about the rich and the poor.
The rich and the poor, and how the rich are seen in one way and the poor are seen in another. And the rich are seen as, you know, he says, when you have no money, nobody trusts you, nobody believes you, nobody likes you. Because to have money is to be virtuous, honest, beautiful, and witty. And to be without is to be ugly and boring and stupid and useless. And you have to take that in context of this is in the middle of the trial. And he's playing, the rag picker is playing the role of one of those president type
people. He's explaining perspective on rich versus poor.
Exactly.
Not his own, yeah.
So that's a very, very, very important moment.
That, and in fact that has one of my little green flags on it.
Thank goodness
book.
It did, because I would never have... but there are a lot of wonderful, wonderful lines. It's a play that everybody is going to take something from. I believe that everybody will walk away thinking. And this is one of the reasons that we do theater, is not just to entertain, and it's certainly going to be entertaining, but also to, in some small way, change people's perspective.
Yes.
You know, to have... I want people to walk out of that theater, whether they love it, hate it, didn't agree, do agree. I want them to talk about it. That's why we do this, because we want people to maybe just a little shift of perception.
Change their minds a little bit.
Maybe, and maybe not. And it doesn't matter if it changes their minds, but I want a conversation to begin somehow.
Right.
So.
That's wonderful. One last question, Barbara, kind of quickly. What was the hardest thing about directing this for you?
Nothing.
hardest?
It's not over yet, so I can't say what was the hardest. I don't know. A little, you know, sort of wrangling all of those personalities and scheduling is always difficult.
Oh, yeah. With 24 people?
With 24 people, our first run-through with an entirely full cast was Monday night.
Wow.
So up until that point, we've had people standing in for other people when we needed to, but that was maybe the most difficult. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Barbara Hatch, director of The Mad Woman of Chaillot, and Karen Lee, the leading lady. The play opens Friday, January 9th at the Santa Fe Playhouse. There's also a sneak preview on Thursday. You can go to www.santafeplayhouse.org to find out about tickets. Or you can also call, what's the number?
505-988-4262.
Thanks so much to both of you for being here today.
Thank you, Hollis. Thank you.